Johann Sebastian and Philip Adams welcome you to LNL. Later on in the program, I'll be talking to a very bouncy, amiable academic called William Clark, whose new book published by Oxford is Sex and the Origins of Death. And having had a whiz through the book, it seems that life was pretty much eternal early on this planet until sex came along. You have sex, you die, basically. So Bella has announced she's giving it up. Chris says she's going to give it up as well. Sue refuses to give it up. And Wendy says she's not going to give up hope. That was a poll we just conducted. Death. It's been a big day for death. I just heard on the news that Jim Cope died. Well, many of us were at the Sydney Town Hall today to say ta-da to Diamond Jim, Jim McClelland. American politics had two Senator McCarthys. There was Eugene McCarthy, who was nice and progressive and liberal, and of course there was Joe McCarthy, whose name is immortalised in McCarthyism, and we had two Senator McClellands. One was Rubber Dougie, Doug McClelland, whose personality lives on in the Barry Humphries character of Les Paterson. Doug was one of the sources of the character. And the other was, of course, Diamond Jim. And it was a typical Labor Party wake. It was great fun. Everyone enjoyed themselves enormously. Gil Appleton, the widow of Diamond Jim, spoke simply and movingly about her husband. And there were very polished performances from John Button, Whitlam, Sir Jim Killen, Don Horn, Robin Nevin, and Paul Keating. But the most extraordinary moment for me was when an old blind man was led to the lectern, an Aboriginal elder from South Australia who'd met Jim when he was running that Royal Commission, the Royal Commission into Maralinga. And he cut through like a knife through butter with that immensely simple dignity that you often find in the Aboriginal community. Anyway, it was a marvellous day, Made me sort of yearn for death a bit, so and as I was walking out of the place, I realised that I've been writing about death for, God help us, for over 30 years, looking at it from one way or another. And, of course, on this program, we've examined it from just about every angle. We've explored the arguments for and against euthanasia, the death penalty, abortion. We've talked to philosophers, psychologists, psychiatrists, theologians, cultural theorists, and we've picked over the bones of death, but we've never really looked at it from a scientific perspective. So let's change that. I want to peer down a very powerful microscope and look at death from a molecular or cellular perspective, and I want to try and find out why and how cells die and whether there was ever a time when death wasn't a part of life. Now, to help me with this task, I have online from his home in California, William Clark. Now, William is Professor of Immunology and Chair Emeritus, which means he must be much older than he sounds, of the Department of Molecular, Cell and Development Biology at UCLA. He's a productive fella, the author of At War Within, The Double-Edged Sword of Immunity, The New Healers, The Promise and Problems of Molecular Medicine in the 21st Century, and the book I hold in my right hand, Sex and the Origins of Death. Now, William, before we get into the complexities, would you be kind enough to tell us what you mean when you talk about death as opposed to the theologians or others?
Death has many faces, and as a biologist, I look at it from a particular slant. Biologists, like other scientists, are sort of reductionists at heart, and so we might ask, what is the smallest thing of which we can say this is alive? And that's of interest, of course, because the smallest thing that is alive is also the smallest thing that can be dead. And from a biological perspective, that's clearly a cell. Viruses are not really alive. They're smaller than cells, but they're not really alive. So the sort of atom of life, if you will, is the cell. A cell can extract energy from the universe and do work with it, and most importantly, it can reproduce itself in a DNA-driven fashion. So what we're really interested in is how cells die. How is a dead cell different from a live cell, and what's involved in the process and the transition from a cell being alive to a cell being dead? And the belief being that if we understand death at that level, then we can build back up and, from a biological perspective, perhaps gain some insight into the death of living organisms.
Now, you say in the book that there are two types of death at the cellular level. Could you explain what they are?
Indeed. Two kinds of death at the cellular level, which in a sense reflect two kinds of death at the level of the whole organism. Those two kinds of death are what we call accidental death, sometimes called necrosis. And the other kind of death, which is perhaps more interesting, is what we call programmed death. Accidental death is obvious. If you hit a cell with a hammer and smash it into oblivion, of course the cell dies.
But you're talking about cellular suicide.
No. That's the other kind of death. Cells as organisms can die for reasons entirely outside themselves. If a cat gets run over by a car, that's an accidental form of death. But a cat could also die from some internal disease, which may reflect various kinds of programmed death.
But yes, in my enthusiasm, I'm rushing ahead. I see the point. You've got necrosis versus the programmed cell death.
Right. I mean, if we go to, for example, single cell organisms, it's sometimes easier to begin these sorts of examinations by looking at situations where the cell is the organism and the organism is a cell. We're just dealing with a single cell, but it's very much alive, and all of the parameters of being alive or being dead apply to these single cell organisms as much as to a multicellular organism like you or me. Now, if we look at something like paramecia, which one of these little things that's not quite visible to the naked eye, but they swim around in ponds. They belong to a group of organisms called ciliated protozoans. Now, these cells, it's very interesting. If you take one of them and put it into a flask of growth medium, it'll start dividing more or less rapidly. But eventually, it'll slow down. The cells actually perceive these cells getting old, and at some point they slow down and stop dividing altogether, and then they die.
So cellular death isn't like a light globe going; it is a process.
It's a process, and it's reflected in you and me, for example, by the aging process, which terminates in death. But the point is, with these unicellular organisms undergoing programmed cell death, There's nothing wrong. I mean, they have plenty of food, they have plenty of oxygen, they're provided with every possible thing that they could need to be alive and healthy, but at some point, the process starts to slow down, and we see these cells aging and then dying. Now, the very interesting thing is, and you alluded to this in your introductory remarks, life was present on Earth for a billion years or so before this phenomenon made its appearance. The very first living things on Earth were what we call prokaryotes, represented today by the bacteria, which have been very successful, obviously, and are still here several billion years later. But for the first billion years of life on Earth, those were the only kind of life forms that there were. Now, you don't see this aging and obligatory death in bacteria. They divide and divide quite happily, and they will die accidentally, of course, if you boil them or steam them or treat them with certain chemicals, they'll die. But that's an accidental form of death. That's a death imposed on them from the outside. There's nothing inherent, and this is the interesting lesson from studying the bacteria, there's nothing inherent in life which demands death. Death is something which made its appearance on the Earth at a certain stage in evolution.
Why? Can you begin to understand why?
Well, that was a question that intrigued me. Why, precisely? Why do things die? Why do these slightly evolutionarily more advanced cells ultimately die? And then, of course, these cells became multicellular and ultimately became you and me. And I think we want to understand why these cells died in the first place, which will give us some insight, I think, into how, or rather, why more complex organisms like you and I ultimately die. As suggested by the title of the book, a major factor in the appearance of this form of programmed death was almost certainly the introduction of sex.
There's no such thing as a free lunch, is there?
Well, it's like your mother and my mother told us. we shouldn't do this.
Yeah, stop it or you'll go blind. Yeah.
Yes, precisely so. Well, you see, when the next stage beyond prokaryotes in evolution were what we call eukaryotes. They're called that because these cells have now gained a nucleus, and they keep their DNA inside of a nucleus, and they have two copies of every chromosome and many other kinds of differences. But perhaps the most important one is that they then, at that stage, began using sex in reproduction. Now, it's very important to be clear what a biologist means about sex. Sex.
You can really talk dirty. We've got a very mature audience here.
You have to yes, you have to address it very seriously. The meaning of sex from a purely biological point of view means nothing more than the combining together of DNA from two different organisms. The most important part of that is that what comes out of that is a combination of DNA, a combination of genes that didn't exist before. So you create completely new genetic combinations during sex. One can see the problem that this introduces. Again, if we go to these ciliated protozoa like Paramecia or Tetrahymena or various others, what happened in these organisms, they had become very, very large. They were still single cells, but they had gotten enormously large, perhaps a million times as large as a bacterium in terms of three-dimensional volume and structure. And there's a lot of problems. There's a lot of advantages of getting large. You're a much better predator. In fact, these ciliated protozoa eat bacteria for lunch. And so that's certainly an advantage of science.
Given that they're a million times larger, how the hell do they know?
Well, they eat a lot of them.
Oh, I see.
But the problem is, when you get that large, you need to make so many proteins so fast just to stay alive, to make the enzymes you need to repair damage somewhere in the cell. I mean, you need enormous amounts of protein, and you run out of DNA. You don't have enough copies of genes to read them off, Xerox them off fast enough to make the proteins you need. So what these Paramecia did to get around this problem was to split their DNA in half, and this is where the real seed of the whole problem is. They split their DNA in half. They took one half of the DNA and they put it in a nice neat little package over in the corner of the cell and said, I'm only going to use that when I reproduce, when I have sex. The rest of they took the other half of the DNA and they ran off thousands and thousands of copies of it, made just a huge pile of DNA, and they said, okay, now I'm going to use this DNA to operate the cell. Now I have lots and lots of copies of every gene, and I'm going to use this DNA to run the cell. Well, now that solved the problem of not having enough DNA to run the cell to make all the proteins that were needed. The problem that created was the following. When two Paramecia get together and have sex and exchange DNA, they exchange copies of this little special subset of DNA that they put away for sex. So they exchange that between themselves, and in the process they create completely new combinations of genes that didn't exist before.
If only cells had remained celibate, they'd have a much longer life, wouldn't they? Well, they did.
Well, and so would we. Because here's the problem. When they make these new combinations of genes through sex, the whole purpose of making those new combinations was to see if they couldn't get something that worked a little bit better, that would give that particular organism, that new organism, a leg up on everybody else. Well, in order to do that, you need to express those genes, and you need to use them to operate the cell. So what the Paramecia does is, after they have sex and create this brand new genotype, we call a combination of genes, they now go ahead and make millions of copies of each of them separate. They have their sex and separate, and each takes their new little reproductive DNA, and they use that to make thousands of copies of this new genetic combination. Well, now they're stuck with this old genetic combination sitting around in the cell, which they no longer want to use. And in fact, what we see is that this this programmed death, which is so characteristic of cells all the way through evolution up through us, we see that, in fact, they get rid of this old DNA that they were using to operate the cell before. They get rid of it by this programmed cell death mechanism. And therein, I think, really lies the seed of our own demise, because what happened after the next stage in evolution, living organisms became multicellular, going from single-cell paramecia into multicellular organisms, and they took the reproductive DNA and put that into what we now call germ cells, which are the sperm and ova of mammals. The other DNA that was used to operate the paramecium, the non-reproductive DNA, became the, what we call now somatic DNA, and that's basically all of the other DNA in our bodies. So in a sense, our germ cells are the direct descendants of that reproductive DNA back in the paramecia, and the rest of us is the direct descendant of the DNA that it used to operate the cell. So it turns out that the only function of the somatic cells and the somatic DNA in a complex organism like you and me is to...
I like the way you assume I'm a complex mechanism. It's very flattering. I am, in fact, a very simple person.
Well, compared to a paramecium, we're fairly complicated. And so once, just as with the paramecium, when it creates new genetic combinations through sex, it has to destroy the old operative or somatic DNA. The same thing happens in multicellular organisms, and the same thing happens in us. Basically, everything that you and I cherish about ourselves, our ability to think or sing a song or fly an airplane or do whatever, read a book, those are all really functions of the somatic DNA. And with every generation, when we create new genetic combinations through sexual combination with another individual, the old DNA, unfortunately, just has to be gotten rid of. So we're in a tough spot as somatic DNAs.
Now let's go from the micro to the macro and deal with a paradox. I like this program to be nice and tabloid. It gets more audience that way. Now, let's look at the death of a person. Now, here's the irony. The person is deemed dead, but of course within that person there's a seething hotbed, is there not, of living cells?
Well, yes, and of course, in an organism such as a mammal, a human, not all cells are equal. Clearly, we can have enormous numbers of our cells die, and it doesn't bother us at all. I mean, you could lose an arm. Well, I mean, that's a huge number of cells, and those cells will die. But you, as a person, or the person losing the arm, doesn't die. On the other hand, if you lose a few heart cells, too many heart cells, and the heart stops beating and doesn't send blood and oxygen and
food, a bit more of a problem.
Yes. So there's a hierarchy of cells, and the cells of the heart and ultimately of the brain are the ones that lead to death in the vast majority of cases.
Mm. Has there been what sort of response has there been to your book, William?
Well, I think it's been very encouraging. I've got very interested in this process of cell death. I think you may have mentioned also that this way of a cell of dying by programmed cell death is sometimes referred to as suicide, because whereas most cells will resist dying with everything at their command, there are certain situations in which cells actually operate this program on their own. And it turns out that the program for cell death is embedded in every single cell in the body. And there are a very large number of situations where this program comes into operation. For example, in a developing embryo, there's a stage in the development of the hand when...
Oh, no, this is wonderful. Listen to this, Gladys. This is a really interesting point.
Yeah, well, it's one of many examples that one could find in embryos. But there's a point at which, when the hand is developing, the fingers are still bound together by a sort of web structure. The hand starts out actually as a paddle, and then the various fingers, or if it's a foot, the toes, condense from collagen and make individual fingers. But there's a point at which they're all still held together by this webbing. Of course, in something like a duck, it never does go away. It just remains there. But in humans and other mammals, the cells between the fingers, the webbing cells, die on cue at a certain point. In humans, it's about 5.5 weeks of fetal development. Those cells just die.
Mm.
Now, when people observe that for a very long time before somebody asked the question, well, how do they die? And if you look at cell death, if you look at accidental cell death, for example, if a cell is starved of oxygen, let's say one of those cells in your brain that doesn't get enough oxygen because your heart's not functioning properly, those cells will fight with everything available to them to avoid dying. And when they finally do die, it's just a terrible, messy sort of death. The cells finally run out of energy, they can't operate their membrane pumps, and water comes rushing in, and at some point they just blow up. And it's just a big mess.
I think on that happy note, we'll have to wind it up, William, but thank you enormously for your time. William R. Clark, Sex and the Origins of Death. It's not a huge book, and it's exquisitely written. So thanks for your time.